Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Richard Rossi Live. We're discussing today a matter of eternal significance, theological significance, the issue of hell. I saw a film that really just floored me how well done it was. The New York Times said that the film Hellbound was substantive and even-handed. That's the quote, substantive and even-handed. And I agree with the New York Times. Kevin Miller, the director, tried to get the views of people all along the continuum on various theological views, from people that think it's all bunk and atheist to the extreme right fringe of the Fred Phelps crowd and everyone along the continuum that he could. So we'll be back in 20 seconds with Kevin to discuss the film Hellbound and maybe anything new he's working on. And by the way, we have a call-in number. It's 347-637-2379 if you want to join the discussion or ask a question. And we'll be back in 20 seconds with director Kevin Miller. Welcome back to Richard Rossi Live, and welcome, Kevin, and thank you for making this film. What a film you made.
Oh, thank you very much. Great to be here.
Kevin, I'd heard, and correct me if I'm wrong, that you were in school for theological studies. Did you go into film after that, or were you always involved in film, or how did those two worlds come together for you?
They're kind of separate worlds, I think. I had done some theological training, I guess, prior to moving into filmmaking, for sure. I mean, film and screenwriting and that sort of thing had been something I'd always been interested in, but I guess I didn't quite make it a career until about 9 years ago. So, but yeah, I think it's only natural that a lot of the theological interests that I have would just work their way into filmmaking. In fact, the first documentary I did was called Expelled, No Intelligence mm-hmm. Allowed. I was a co-writer on that film, and that was looking at the issue of intelligent design. So, you know, even with the first film I looked at, there's some, you know, theological questions being asked. And I think film is just really, it can be a frustrating medium to work in because oftentimes you don't have the time required to go really in-depth into these subjects. But at the same time, I think what a documentary can do is make some of these really complex ideas accessible for a broader audience. So perhaps to serve as a platform for discussion and maybe further investigation.
Yeah, I enjoyed the Expelled film a lot, and you know, have friends on all sides of that. I thought Ben Stein was also very good in the film. You know, did you see the big debate they had? Was it who was Ken Ham and the Science Guy on that recently? I don't know if you saw that, but it was a creationist evolution debate, but I think your film touched on it very well. That whole it seemed like there was a prejudice against the intelligent design people that was really shown in the film, wasn't there?
Yeah, well, yeah, I didn't watch the Bill Nye Ken Ham debate because I just kind of feel that's a little bit of grandstanding that really doesn't have anything to do with trying to get at the truth. But yeah, in terms of Expelled, what we tried to look at was this question of intelligent design. The interesting thing about it is that there's all kinds of hijacking going on, and so people are trying to hijack science. People are trying to, you know, basically use science to promote their worldview. And what was happening with the intelligent design thing is that people who were promoting intelligent design were being accused of being closet creationists, of just trying to use, you know, intelligent design as a Trojan horse through which mm-hmm. they could insert their religious views. And what we tried to show in the film is that actually everybody's doing that. You know,
yeah.
Everybody has some kind of a philosophical or religious agenda, and they're trying to use science to really present a reasonable case for it. And what we tried to show in the film is that actually there may be people within the intelligent design movement who are very much theologically motivated, but the idea that the universe may have come about through some form of intelligence is a thoroughly scientific question that then leads to scientific hypotheses and experimentation, all that sort of thing. So I think hopefully what the film does is at least say, you know, that's one of the options on the table when it comes to trying to figure out how did everything come to be here.
Well, it was very well done, and even more controversial, your film Hellbound. Growing up, were you a child when you first heard, you know, the idea of the eternal hell, and was it a scary concept when you first heard it? How did it affect you?
Yeah, I became a Christian at age 9 at a Bible camp, and prior to that weekend, I'd never, heard anything about the gospel, really. I don't even know if I was aware of hell at that point. But I definitely came away from that experience very conscious of hell. I have a vivid memory of that summer. I grew up on a farm. I remember walking out one evening to go help my family weed in the garden, and I stopped on the driveway and looked at them, and I just had this sick feeling in my stomach that if they didn't come to learn what I had just learned, they were all going to go to hell. And I don't really remember, in the gospel presentation that I was given, it was the most, by the most loving, caring people who just, were looking out for my welfare. And so I don't think that they meant to terrorize me, but I definitely was terrorized. And, it's one of those things that just sort of percolated underneath the surface of my life for many years, as it does for many people who, have a hard time wrestling with these concepts.
Yeah, when we watched your film and we showed it to several friends, had them over to see it, and it seemed like in the film, and this might be me just looking for a pattern, and I'd be curious what you think about it, but it seemed like the people that held to the harshest view, why don't you, because a lot of our listeners are not, exposed to the church to the degree you and I have. You talked about three main views in the film, right? Would you mind explaining that for those that aren't aware of those?
Yeah, well, Hellbound, just to summarize too, it's a feature-length documentary that takes a critical look at this what many people assume is the traditional view of hell as a place of eternal torment. But what we try and show in the film is that throughout the history of Christianity, and this is within what would be considered Orthodox Christianity, there's been three main families of views. One would be the idea of eternal torment or eternal separation. So this is what happens to sinners when they die, is they're sequestered somewhere, and they're either going to suffer the natural deprivations that you would experience being separated from all that's good, or maybe there's actually an active form of torment that's happening as a form of retribution. So that's definitely, I would say, if you ask most people to define hell, that's how they would picture it. But alongside those views are two other minority positions that have been present in the church from the beginning. And one of them is called annihilationism or conditional immortality. This is the idea that eternal life is a gift that's only bestowed upon the righteous. And so the unrighteous will either be annihilated or they just simply won't be resurrected, at the end of things. And then there's the idea of universalism or ultimate reconciliation. And this is the view that all people will ultimately be reconciled to God and to each other. And what many people don't realize about this view is that most people who hold to a view of ultimate reconciliation also believe in some form of post-mortem punishment. They just believe that it's remedial instead of retributive. So in other words, it's there as a corrective, cleansing, purifying measure as opposed to just simply exacting vengeance.
Mm. Yeah, I just finished reading our mutual friend Frank Schaeffer's novel, and it's interesting, at the end he makes a comment in that novel, In God Said Billy, about the fire of God. I think he has a monk character that talks about the same consuming fire of the love of God being experienced differently by different people depending on where they're at. That kind of was touched on a little bit too. I think you had a wonderful Orthodox priest that really, really we loved as well. And of course, Frank Schaeffer's comments were great. It also struck me, go ahead, Kevin.
Yep. Well, I was just going to jump in and say I think there is a fourth view, and that would be the Orthodox view, is that nothing can separate us from the love of God. But we experience the love of God differently depending on our emotional and psychological state. And so if it could burn us like fire, or it could be the most splendid thing we've ever experienced. It all depends on where our heart is at.
Mm.
So, yeah.
And I wanted to let you know that are listening to see this film. Well, there's a website, hellboundthemovie.com, and also on Amazon. I bought this on Amazon, and it's available. I guess are those the two best places, Kevin, to get the film?
Yeah, hellboundthemovie.com, and yeah, you can purchase the DVD on Amazon as well. And for those people who are listening outside of North America, we ship outside of North America, or you can also view the film digitally. And the film is on Netflix as well, so
people
can watch it there too.
And you're in British Columbia right now?
I am, and it's snowing heavily right now.
Well, I'm in California, so it's definitely not snowing here, but what a magical thing that we can do this show and have listeners all over the world. We have listeners in the United States, and we hear from listeners in Europe, and this film really struck my wife and I. We met at a fundamentalist Bible college, Jerry Falwell's Bible College, and we were sent out. We had a soul-winning class, evangelism class, and there was a professor, J.O. Grooms, recommended a soul-winning tool called The Burning Hell. It was not as well-made as your film, I can tell you that, but it was basically about 20 minutes of all these images of people in the fire and screaming and, you know, and worms, you know, on their faces, and this was to scare people into believing. And I noticed that the people that seem to have the harshest view of God to me in the film also seem to be kind of the meanest people. And I don't know if that's an oversimplification, but do you think that our view of God, determines the kind of people we become?
Well, you know, I think it's almost, it can go both ways. I think that the type of people we are almost determines the type of God we create. You know, Voltaire, he said, you know, God created us in his image and we've returned him the favor. And I think he says that a little tongue-in-cheek, but I think there's a lot of truth to it. You know, Thomas Talbot, who's a universalist philosopher who I interviewed for the film, but he's actually not in the film. He's on the DVD, Special Features. He says that, you know, we don't read the Bible the way it is. We read the Bible the way we are. And so, depending on our life's experiences, you know, the Bible's interpreting us as much as we're interpreting the text. And so I think that, you know, it could be that having an image of an angry God makes us into angry people, because we then are motivated by fear. We're motivated oftentimes by a purity motive. And so if God demands absolute purity, then we demand that as well. And so we become heresy hunters, and we become people who are always trying to stamp things out, you know, as opposed to allow things to flourish. And so if we have an image of God instead that isn't about demanding that we attain some high level, you know, to leap over this bar, but is in fact a God who's descended to us and is, you know, trying to lift us up, then, you know, I think it would make sense that we would become like that God. But if we've had life experiences where life has taught us that, you know, people who are in authority are demanding and difficult and never giving us approval, I think we tend to project those types of ideas onto God as well. And so, you know, I think it's a reciprocal thing, and it's very complicated. And that's where I think that some of these beliefs that we form, a lot of people want to say, you know, it's in the Bible, just read it. It's right there in the Bible. Well, we all approach the Bible through a very complex grid of life experiences and philosophical ideas, and so it's just never that simple. But yeah, I think that, you know, you can turn the sound off on the film and watch people talk and probably guess what position they're coming from, I think, by just their demeanor.
Wow. Yeah, what an insight. So the Bible can kind of be like the Rorschach test where we're projecting into it, huh?
Yeah, I think it can be. And, you know, yeah, so I think that as there's also, whatever text you're reading, there's a reciprocal relationship that the things that jump out at you, they say as much about you as they do about the text, because every interpretive grid we're going to bring to the Bible, it's like a lens on a camera, right? Some things are going to be in focus, other things are going to be blurry. And, you know, there's a guy, Jonathan Haidt, he wrote a book called The Righteous Mind, which I'm just really enjoying right now, and he talks about our view of morality. He says it both binds us and it blinds us. And I think that's true of kind of any sort of position that we've landed on.
Yeah, I was in a play as an actor, Elmer Gantry. I played Elmer Gantry, and there was a prostitute character that my character had an affair with, and she had a fundamentalist father who would write her letters about how she was going to burn in hell. And there's a line she said in the play, why is it some people only find hate in the Bible and some people only find love? And you had the Phelps in the film, of course. I thought it was really interesting having them in the film. I know some people may have criticized that, but I was actually protested by the Phelps because my wife and I ministered to AIDS patients and homosexuals, and because of our fundamentalist background, the Phelps showed up and were calling me a fag lover and everything, and And they scared me. They actually, I felt kind of traumatized by their protests. My children were little. I was amazed how calm you were when Fred Phelps' daughter was, you know, calling you name. It felt to me like she was name calling, almost, you know, verbal abuse, if not verbal abuse, very close to it. And you remained pretty calm. I mean, are you good at being calm like that? I mean, you seem to really hold it together there.
Well, that's called the magic of movie editing. Yeah, no, I'm just kidding. It was, you know, going head to head with Margie Phelps like that is it was a bit of a surreal experience for me. And so she's a very smart individual, and mm-hmm. for me, what I was focused on was trying to maintain as much control of the interview as I could, and just really try to stay a step ahead of her if I could. And so these types of things that she was calling me is only after the fact, you know, I realized she kept calling me ma'am. You know, and, you know, she had assumed right away that, I, you know, in her terminology, I was a fag, and that was my main problem. And, you know, so she, didn't resist from that. But I found it very difficult to take it personally, because you realize with somebody like her, she's got an axe to grind, she's angry, she's got an agenda. And so if you move into her orbit, you naturally become a target for that. And it's not that she's singled out you in particular because she hates you. It's just you're there, and so watch out, you know. And so I just didn't think I got personally too caught up in things. Although, you know, it was an interesting dynamic as well, because off camera there's a whole crowd of people watching us, plus off camera my wife and her brother, who's actually gay, was there with his partner. And so my wife was the one who was, if anybody was really angry during that interview, it was her. She was seething.
Mm. Yeah, on the, and of course the Phelps representing the eternal torment view. Also on the view, and I know, quite frankly, I thought Mark Driscoll, who, and I've been out of the evangelical world's, you know, subculture for a while. I was in it, you know, when I was younger. But I've tried to exist more in the real world in terms of my work as an actor and all that. But I get the feeling from my friends in that culture that he's a pretty big name in that culture, and yet his views to me came across theologically very similar to the Phelps in the sense of, you know, God has predestined, you know, most of humanity to damnation. You had that haunting cut where he's preaching, God hates many of you. I mean, it felt like he, in terms, I mean, he might be come across more balanced in his media interviews and things, but it seemed like theologically they're both on that side. Would that be the case? Or?
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the points we tried to make in the film, is that if you look at Mark Driscoll or Kevin DeYoung or Justin Taylor, who all represent Reformed Christianity in the film, we also have John Piper in there. Really, all of the Phelps are, and the Phelps of the Westboro Baptist Church, are just a hyper form of Reformed Christianity or Calvinism. And so, and that's something we tried to draw a relationship between. And so I would say that Mark Driscoll is just, you know, a better-looking, clean-cut, funnier version of the Phelps in a lot of ways, because he'll say exactly the same things. Mm-hmm. And his theological grid is exactly the same. And you'll see even John Piper, for instance, you know, faced a lot of criticism over the last year for basically saying that God is in the business of killing people, essentially, men, women, and children, any hour of the day. That if people die, whether by a gunshot or an earthquake, it's God who basically, you know, in a sense, is pulling the trigger. And that's really an inescapable view if you have this view of God's sovereignty that these people have, is that God ultimately is responsible for everything that happens. And, yeah, so it's unfortunate because, you know, I think it's a very damaging theology for a lot of people.
Mm. Yeah, I think it has to damage it. For me to believe God is that monstrous would have mental health implications. And I sit here amazed that a man like Mark Driscoll with that view has attracted so many followers, because the God he's talking to represent God that way seems just so monstrous to me. But a lot of us that come from some abuse in our background, you know, I guess we're more vulnerable maybe to buy into that. But on the universalism side was very interesting too, and you mentioned Thomas Talbot. I enjoyed his book, I think it was called Inescapable Love of God. And
yep.
There was a young man that was interesting to me because it seemed like he embraced that position, and forgive my brain fart at the moment, but he embraced that position and then since went back on that position. Was that the case?
Chad, Chad Holtz. It presented a bit of a conundrum for us. So Chad Holtz is featured in the film. He was a pastor who came to an agreement with his church that it was best for him to leave because he had become quite bold in stating his views, not just on universalism, but on same-sex marriage and a number of other issues. And so at the time we interviewed him, I think I talked to him for about 2 hours on camera. He's very articulate in his defense of universalism. I threw all kinds of, devil's advocate questions at him and that sort of thing. And this was obviously a position that he had spent many years working out while in seminary and that sort of thing. And so a couple of months before we were going to release the film, it became known that he had recanted his position. And the circumstances were that he had entered a treatment facility for sex addiction, and so it was a evangelical Christian-based treatment program, and he emerged from that, basically had written a letter recanting all of his views, saying he'd been arrogant and all that sort of thing. And so that put us in a conundrum, because we basically have the film finished, and now this guy's changing his views. And so we considered cutting him from the film, perhaps replacing him with someone else who had gone through a similar experience. But after consulting with a number of people, we decided to move forward because his about-face had been so sudden and abrupt and nonsensical from my point of view that who was to say he wasn't going to do another about-face 2 months later,
Mm-hmm.
And I felt that what we had documented was where he stood at the time, and also the arguments that he made, I felt were quite cogent, and mm-hmm. and that these weren't arguments he had arrived at overnight. And to be honest, to this day, I'm very suspicious that that really the letter that he wrote, I know that he was having marital difficulties and that sort of thing, and I think that rather than representing a true change of heart, I think it just represented him trying to, hold his family together and just try and get his life back on track. And I would never, begrudge somebody wanting to do that. But that's really kind of, for me, that's how we justified, moving ahead with him in the film, even though he had a change of heart.
Yeah, I'm glad you still included him because he did, ask some really good questions, and one of them was, he said why he couldn't understand why more people didn't question this kind of monster God that the Phelps and Mark Driscoll talk about, that one of the women in the film, illustrated it humorously that, okay, I'm creating Bill now. Okay, Bill, you go to heaven. I'm creating Bob now. Bob, you're going to hell. And
yep.
He said, why don't more people in this world even question it? Why do they just accept that? And another question would be, in light of how maybe he had to save his marriage by recanting, why do people react so vehemently? And I mean, just people freak out if in the fundamentalist world, if you even suggest, universal reconciliation. Why do you think it's so heated? Why do people defend it with such emotion?
Well, I think that it's partly ignorance. I think that people aren't aware historically of the diversity of opinions within the church. Like, there's actually a new book has come out, like a 900-page book on that does an intense study of language, Greek language, in terms of the view of universalism, and not just looking at biblical text, but extra-biblical text. And one of the conclusions the author comes away from is a strong feeling that universalism may have been the majority position for the first several centuries of the church, along with pacifism as well. And so this is something that people just simply aren't aware of, number one. And I think number two is throughout the history of the church, and maybe in more recent times, although I think this even goes back to Origen, one of the early church fathers, who was a universalist, is that universalism or ultimate reconciliation often is accompanied by other unorthodox beliefs. And so when those unorthodox beliefs, like, say, questioning the Trinity and that sort of thing, when they get tossed out, universalism goes with it. But I think that the other side of it is that we are in the grip, goes back to Voltaire saying that we've created God in our own image, is that as a culture, we're in the grip of a retributive mindset. There's this logic that makes the world work where you do the crime, you do the time. When somebody attacks the United States, on 9/11, what ends up happening is the response is 10 years of war, and so there's just this this eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, you take out my eye, I'll take out your family type thing. And it just seems to be the logic of the world. And so for us to think that God would operate any other way, it just sort of defies logic. And the funny thing to me, though, is that what the gospel should be is the antidote to the logic of the world. It shouldn't be the ultimate affirmation of the logic, because if we look at Christ on the cross, what Christ represents at that moment is the one who absolutely refuses to engage in the violence of his persecutors. He refuses retribution, even though, you know, right up to the last minute, you know, people are trying to hand him a sword and say, let's go for it. He refuses to mirror the violence of his enemies. And so what is revealed on the cross is the nonviolent heart of God. And I think that's one of the most offensive things in the world, because we all want vengeance, because we all want to be justified. We all want whatever we believe to be justified, and Christ refuses to do it. And I think it's frustrating. And so I think that's one of the main reasons why we find this idea of universalism so offensive, because it just does not fit our paradigm. But I think, again, Jesus came to explode our paradigm, not offer some kind of divine affirmation of it.
Wow, yeah, I think about him on the cross praying, Father, forgive them, they know not what they do. And these are people that, you know, are killing him, not believing in him at this point, not praying a prayer to ask him in their heart or anything. They're killing him, and he's saying, forgive them. You know, this complete forgiveness.
Well, and if you talk to Frank Schaefer, he says at that moment, hell's over. Because if there's any time for Jesus to say, Father, you know, damn them all, that's the moment to do it. And even when Jesus comes back, the big shock to everyone is that when he is resurrected, is that he's not coming back for blood. When the people, you know, when Peter preaches in Acts 2 and the people are struck to the heart, when he tells them that this Jesus whom you killed, they're mortified because they realize that they've just killed God. So what does the logic say? Uh-oh, God's going to come back and get us. But this is the good news, is that God's not seeking retribution. In fact, it's through the worst act you could have committed that God has engineered your salvation. And so, again, I just think that, you know, I mean, obviously I'm a universalist or somebody who believes in ultimate reconciliation, but I just feel that, you know, so often these types of discussions get reduced to, you know, well, what about this verse versus that verse, or this parable versus that parable? But I kind of stand back and look at the overall logic of the gospel and what is really being revealed here. And it seems to me that it's so hard to come away from that big picture with the idea of a God who's looking for retribution. Because it seems to me what's very clear is we are looking for retribution. Hmm. And that we sought to exact that retribution from Christ. And that rather than mirror that, he showed us, he became a model for us to show us how to escape that cycle. And so it's not sinners in the hands of an angry God. It's a God in the hand of angry sinners. You know, so if there's any violence that's happening at the crucifixion, it's purely human. You know, it's not God exacting vengeance. It's us. And God, he's submitting himself to that, because that's the only way that we can, in a sense, be woken up.
Wow, that's so profound, Kevin. We seek the retribution. I was thinking as you were talking about the whole Left Behind series, and there was a video game where the Christians get to come back and kind of, you know, kill the unbelievers, and you know they're shooting. It was like, I think there is a certain joy that people have in believing this. You know, Jesus is coming back and he's really pissed, and we're going to kick everyone's butts, kind of thing.
Well, I think that, again, like if we look at, you know, so when Jesus comes back from the dead, he's not seeking retribution, but, oh, I guess he's going to seek retribution when he comes, you know, in the second time. And so then, you know, right away you have a total breakdown in logic again, because, well, then what was going on the cross then? If Jesus isn't seeking retribution then, which is the perfect time to do it, why is he going to come back and seek it later on? And so I think that, again, what we tend to do is take a book of Revelation, the book of Revelation in the Bible, and we start to seek out these retributive images. And I think that read in a certain way, these types of images will leap out at you, if you're going to read it as if this is sort of a literal depiction of what's going to happen instead of realizing that, oh, when Jesus comes back, the sword isn't in his hand that lays the nations low. It's the sword is coming out of his mouth. What is the sword? It's the word. Well, how is it going to lay low the nations? Because it's going to take away the power that they have to convince people to continue to engage in these retributive mindsets. And I think that's what we see the gospel doing right now. You know, we are more attuned to victims than ever. In fact, the easiest way to persecute somebody now is to claim victim status, because then that seems to justify your violence against somebody else. Well, you know, I'm a victim, so we have to make sure this never happens again, so let's go get those guys. But I think that on a more positive note, I think what the gospel is doing as it percolates through the culture is it's showing, it's harder and harder to rally a group of people around a scapegoat anymore, because we know, because of the gospel, what the gospel reveals is that the mob who killed Jesus were the guilty ones, not Jesus. And we tend to be a culture that sort of builds our whole culture around persecuting scapegoats, and it's harder and harder to do that. So I think that, you know, the reason why the word of God is going to lay low the nations is because it's going to be harder and harder for tyrants to really, convince people to form a mob and to do their work. And so, I don't know, I just see really from tip to tail what's happening throughout the scripture is an emergence from this idea that God is this violent retributive God. What's emerging throughout all of the text to me is this separation of God from violence, which is something that we really hit on in Hellbound. So when it comes to how will God finally deal with sinners in the end, to me, it can't be purely retributive, because that undoes everything that Christ came to show us. Because I think that if God truly is loving and God truly is just, well, then any punishment that comes from God would have to be infinitely loving, infinitely just, and the only way it can be that way is if it has the best interest of the wrongdoer in mind. So I don't think that any punishment that could come from God could ever be purely retributive. It would have to be restorative. It would have to be aimed toward rehabilitation and reconciliation. Otherwise, it's not loving. Otherwise, it becomes self-justifying in the same way that we want to all be self-justified. Because if God is purely retributive, God's just concerned about God's self. But what Jesus came to show us is that God is inherently other-centered, and so that anything God does must be for the welfare of others, not for God's self. You know, so that this for me, again, this is the good news of the gospel, because that means that the best news of the world is that God is not like us. You know?
Wow.
That's good news.
Thank you for sharing the good news in your work, and the time has just flown by. I want to tell you, if you're listening, though, to I encourage you guys to really investigate this further. On Kevin's site, hellboundthemovie.com, not only can you see the trailer, can you order the film, but also he has links to and resources on this site, get information on these different views. You can click, I think it's the resources and the websites, and he has books recommended. Kevin and I have both read books on the different views. He mentioned Thomas Talbot's book on Universalism, Inescapable Love of God. And get to that site since we're out of time. We've just scratched the surface on this. See the film, and I'm so grateful you're doing this work. I wish we had time to get into your new film about the homeless, but I guess if they visit your site, they can find everything, huh?
Yeah, that's right. I also blog regularly on pathios.com. I have a blog there called Hellbound. So, yeah, if you just Google me, you can find it. I update on all kinds of things there as well.
Well, keep making more films, Kevin. It was an extremely well-done film. I just the whole ethos of it, shooting there at New York where 911 happened and the way you put it together. And I agree with Frank Schaefer in the New York Times that it was a very even-handed treatment of all the different views. And keep up the good work.
Great. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate you taking the time to help share it with other people.
Okay. God bless you and your family. And thank you, everyone, for tuning in. And we'll be back on Sunday with film director Darla Ray. And until then, think about these things. Think about what is God like, and check out Kevin's film. God bless you until we're back with you.